Thank you. Good afternoon or good morning to those of you on the West, and welcome to the Talking Freight Seminar Series. My name is Jennifer Simone, and I'll be moderating today's seminar. Today's topic is rising fuel prices, the effects of energy prices on global trade patterns. Please be advised that today's seminar is being recorded. Today we'll have two presentations given by David Simkai Levy of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and Greg Forbes of Walmart. We'll then have a facilitated discussion led by Barbara Ivanov of the Washington State DOT with input from Tony First of the FHWA Office of Freight Management and Operations. David Simkai Levy is a professor of engineering systems at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He holds a PhD from Tel Aviv University. His research currently focuses on developing and implementing robust and efficient techniques for logistics systems. He has published widely in professional journals on both practical and theoretical aspects of logistics and supply chain management. Greg Forbes joined Walmart in 1989. He has held positions in internal audit, private fleet corporate traffic, and Sam's distribution and logistics. He currently serves as a senior director, general merchandise traffic in Walmart's corporate traffic department. In this role, he's responsible for the inbound transportation to Walmart and Sam's Club distribution centers, stores, and clubs. He also has responsibility for the internal less-than-truckload consolidation network, Sam's outbound delivery to club, and outbound ocean carrier deliveries for Alaska, Hawaii, and Puerto Rico. Prior to joining Walmart, he graduated from the Missouri State University with a Bachelor of Science degree in accounting. Barbara Ivanov is the director of the Washington State Department of Transportation Freight Systems Division. Her responsibilities include developing the state's strategic investment plan for the freight system and introducing the plan to community and regional leaders to gain regional participation and support. She is currently leading initiatives to improve freight system operational efficiencies, build a data framework to monitor system performance, and develop a resilient freight system. The Freight Systems Division also develops information and strategies to reduce the environmental impacts of freight movements, manages the state's freight research program, and administers the WSDOT freight and passenger rail capital programs and operations. Ms. Ivanov is a graduate of the Executive MBA program at the University of Washington. I'd now like to go over a few logistical details prior to starting the seminar. Today's seminar will last 90 minutes, with 60 minutes for the presenters and the final 30 minutes for audience question and answer. If during the presentation you think of a question, you can type it into the smaller text box underneath the chat area on the right side of your screen. Please make sure you're typing in the thin text box and not the large white area. Please also make sure you send your questions to everyone and indicate which presenter your question is for. The presenters will be unable to answer your questions during their presentations, but I'll start off the question and answer session with the questions typed into the chat box. Once we get through all the questions that have been typed in, the operator will give instructions on how to ask a question over the phone. If you think of a question after the seminar, you can send it to the presenters directly, or I encourage you to use the Freight Planning Listserv. The listserv is an email list and a forum for the distribution of information, as well as a place where you could post questions to find out what other subscribers have learned in the area of freight planning. If you haven't already joined the listserv, the web address at which you could do so is provided on the slide on your screen. Finally, I'd again like to remind you that the session is being recorded. A file containing the audio and the visual portion of the seminar will be posted to the Talking Freight website within the next week. We encourage you to direct others in your office that may have been unable to access the seminar to access the recording. The PowerPoint presentations used during the seminar are available for download from the file download box in the lower right corner of your screen. We actually just have Dr. Simkai Levy's presentation available right now, and there's also a white paper for download that Barbara Ivanov has provided us with, and if you did register in advance, this is the same white paper that I did email out to everybody. So we'll now go ahead and get started. Today's topic, for those of you who just joined us, is rising fuel prices, the effects of energy prices on global trade patterns. Our first presentation will be given by David Simkai Levy of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. As a reminder, if you have questions during the presentation, please type them into the chat box and they'll be answered in the last 30 minutes of the seminar. So with that, David, I'm going to bring up your presentation and you can begin.
Thank you and welcome everybody. I'm going to talk about the impact of oil price on supply chain strategies. A good starting point is to review traditional business strategies. These business strategies include lean manufacturing, outsourcing and offshoring, just-in-time, quick and frequent deliveries. All are strategies that have been used by companies in the last 10, 20 years very successfully. cost, cut inventory, and improve service. All these strategies focus on two important assumptions. One is of cheap oil price, and the other one is of low labor cost in developing countries. Unfortunately, in the last few years, we have seen changes in industry, and these assumptions do not necessarily hold anymore. In fact, when you think about oil price today relative to, say, what we used to have in 2002 and 2003, in 2002, oil price was at about $25 per barrel. Today, it's about $90 per barrel, and 2 months ago, it was about $140 per barrel. Consider labor cost in countries like China and Thailand. Labor cost between 2002 and 2008 in China has increased by more than 150%. Clearly, all these changes will have an impact on transportation strategies, supply chain strategies, and in general, on business strategies. And my objective is to try and review some of these changes. So it's appropriate, for example, to look at U.S. logistics cost. And what I have here in this slide is information on U.S. logistics cost as a percentage of the GDP. As you can see, between 1984 and about 2002, U.S. logistics cost as a percentage of the GDP went continuously down. However, in the last 5 years, we have seen significant increase in U.S. logistics cost as a percentage of the GDP, and there are four reasons for that. First, rising energy prices. Second, limited rail capacity, and as a result, significant increase in rail transportation costs. Also, limited rail capacity implies that shippers start moving shipment from rail to the trucking industry, and therefore we see an increase in truck transportation cost. And finally, security requirement. Implemented after September 11, of course, increase logistics cost significantly. You may ask, what does U.S. logistics cost include? It includes three important components. Administrative cost, mostly the cost of IT, inventory cost, and transportation cost. And the important observation about this graph is that between 2002 in 2007, transportation cost increased by almost 50%. More importantly, inventory cost during the same period of time increased by more than 60%. We understand why transportation cost increased significantly by about 47 or 50%, but why did inventory cost increase so much, even more than the increase in transportation cost? There are a number of drivers. There are a number of reasons for that. First, with offshoring, we see longer lead time. Longer lead time implies more inventory. Second, demanding retailers asking for higher level of service require manufacturers to add more inventory. And finally, I claim that the increase in transportation cost drives inventory level up. Why? Because as transportation costs increase, what we see companies do, they try to take advantage of economies of scale by shipping large quantities. Shipping large quantities is great from transportation cost point of view, but is problematic from the inventory management point of view. And that's what is nicely illustrated with this statistical data that has been collected over the last 23 years. And so my objective, as we talk about the impact of oil price, is to understand the impact of oil price on transportation cost, on the network strategies that companies use, on transportation strategies, and finally on supply chain strategies. And toward the end, we will try to combine the analysis and try and to understand the impact not of all of only oil price, but also the impact of changes in labor cost in developing countries. And so my starting point is to focus on transportation cost. What I did here, I collected data over a period of about 15 years on crude oil price and U.S. diesel fuel price paid by consumers at the pump. As you can see, these two lines move together, which means that as crude oil price change, the price paid by consumer at the pump also change. And this is, of course, not surprising. What I would like to do is to ask three questions. The first question is, can I use information about crude oil price to predict what consumers will pay at the pump for U.S. diesel fuel price? If I can do that, then I will try to ask the question, can I use information about crude oil price to predict the impact on transportation cost paid by the shippers to the carriers? And if I can answer that question, I will ask, can I use information about crude oil price to understand the impact on the network strategies that companies should use? And so right now I will start with the first question, which is focusing on trying to use information on crude oil price to predict the impact on consumer price for U.S. diesel fuel. And this is nicely illustrated in the next slide, where you can see on the x-coordinate information on crude oil price, and on the y-coordinate you see diesel retail price in cents per gallon. And you can see that the correlation between the two is very high. You can also see by looking carefully at the analysis that for $10 increase in crude oil price, we will see on average 24 cents per gallon increase in diesel retail price. Saying it again, this graph suggests that for every $10 per barrel increase in crude oil price, we will see on average about 24 cents per gallon increase in retail price paid by consumers for diesel fuel. What does this mean? Well, we talked to a number of third-party logistics companies, and here is what we found. We found that the standard fuel surcharge methodology that many of these companies use is to increase transportation cost by 1 cent per mile for every 6 cents increase in diesel fuel. This implies, therefore, that for every $10 per barrel increase in crude oil price, we will see about 4 cents per mile increase in transportation rate. Well, you say 4 cents per mile increase in transportation rate is not that high. But if you remember that last October, crude oil price was about $75 per barrel. A few months ago, it was at about $140. And so when crude oil price goes up from $75 to $100, transportation cost goes up by 6%. If crude oil price goes from $75 per barrel, say, to $150 per barrel, then we see 18% increase in transportation rate. Now, that makes a big difference on the type of transportation strategies that companies use. You may ask, what exactly is the impact on the network, given that now we understand the impact on the transportation rate paid by the shippers to the carrier? I want to focus here on three trade-offs. What I claim is that as oil price increase, and to put this in perspective, compare oil price today to oil price in 2002 or 2003, as oil price increase, I'm going to argue that we will see companies trading off oil price for inventory cost, for facility cost, and for manufacturing cost. And to illustrate this, I will use a case study that involves a specific company. This company is a manufacturer of consumer packaged goods. The company has three manufacturing facilities, one in Philadelphia, one in Omaha, and one in Juarez, Mexico. Not surprisingly, the Juarez, Mexico plant is facility. The one in Philadelphia is the more expensive one in terms of production cost. There are about 900 aggregated customers in this network, and on the transportation side, the company uses the following strategy. Inbound transportation uses commercial truckload carriers. These are, of course, large vehicles. And on the outbound, the company is using private fleet, whose capacity is about half of the capacity of the TL carrier. The objective of this engagement, of this case study, was threefold. First, to determine the structure of the network. How many distribution centers, where to locate distribution centers, how to allocate, how to assign customers to the different warehouses. The second objective was to allocate production capacity to the different facilities. Should we split demand equally between the different manufacturing facilities, or maybe the Juarez, Mexico facility should be in charge of satisfying most of the demand, because this is, after all, the low-cost manufacturing facility. And by the way, the company wants to understand the impact of changes in oil price on its distribution and production strategy. Here is their network. Green represent demand points. The size of the dot is proportional to the amount of demand in different regions. There are, you can see the three manufacturing facilities, Juarez, Mexico, Omaha, and Philadelphia. And you can see that basically this company serves customers basically all over the country. And so what I would like to do is to start the discussion by intuitively talking about trade-off, and then we will do a more technical analysis of the trade-offs that this company is facing. Clearly, as crude oil price increase, we see that transportation cost becomes more important relative to inventory cost, relative to facility cost, and relative to production cost. What does this mean? As oil price increase, it becomes more and more important to reduce outbound transportation cost. How can we reduce outbound transportation cost? This is the cost from the distribution centers to the customers, to the retail stores. You can reduce outbound transportation cost by adding more distribution centers. Well, adding more distribution centers implies higher facility cost, but it also demands more inventory. That's why I say we see trade-off between oil price and inventory holding cost and facility cost. What about the trade-off between oil price and production cost? As oil price increase, it becomes more and more important to move production closer to market demand. This basically means that cheaper manufacturing in Mexico is offset by higher transportation costs, right? So these are clearly intuitive trade-offs. The question is what really happens in this supply chain. And you can see that in the next two slides. Here, in this slide, I'm looking at a technical analysis of the trade-off between oil price and inventory carrying cost and facility cost. The map on the left represents the supply chain strategy, the network strategy that this company should use when oil price is at $75 per barrel. You can see that when oil price is at $75 per barrel, this company needs 5 distribution centers. However, when oil price goes to $200 per barrel, the structure of the network is completely different. This company needs a total of 7 distribution centers. I did a sensitivity analysis to understand the impact of oil price on the distribution strategy that this company need. And you can see on the top the different scenarios. I analyze the network when oil price is $75 per barrel, $100 per barrel, all the way to $200 per barrel. For example, you can see that when oil price is $75 per barrel, $100 per barrel, all the way almost to $150 per barrel, this company needs 5 distribution centers, one in Atlanta, one in Chicago, one in Dallas, one in New York, and one in Las Vegas. But at $150 per barrel, something changes. I call this point, $150 per barrel, the tipping point. This is the point where the company needs to change its distribution strategy, close the distribution center, the warehouse in Las Vegas, and replace it by three distribution centers, one in Albuquerque, New Mexico, one in LA, and one in Portland. And you can see that the same structure with now seven distribution centers remain identical, unchanged, for a large values of crude oil price. When I talk to a lot of companies, the question that typically I ask them, do you know your tipping point? Because if your tipping point is $200 per barrel, for example, that's one thing. If your tipping point is at about $100 per barrel, you may be now involved in reconfiguring your supply chain. For this specific company, its tipping point is about $150 per barrel, and the company is taking some action to prepare itself to this type of oil price. What about the trade-off between oil price and production cost? On the left-hand side, you can see the production strategy when oil price is at $75 per barrel, and you can see that in this case, this supply chain needs to satisfy about 75% of total demand from the low-cost manufacturing facility, from the facility in Juarez, Mexico. When oil price goes up from $75 to $200 per barrel, you can see that the optimal production strategy is completely different. The Juarez, Mexico facility reduces its capacity and satisfy only about 50% of total demand, and the Omaha facility satisfies now about 25% of total demand. And the reason for that is because the Omaha facility now satisfies most of the demand in the Midwest, by doing that significantly reducing transportation costs. And so this illustrates the nice trade-off between oil price and production cost that exists in this network. You may ask, well, what is the impact on total cost for this company? Again, I did a sensitivity analysis of impact on total cost as a function of oil price. And you can see, for example, that as oil price increased from $100 per barrel to $150 per barrel, the total cost will increase by about 3%. To put this in perspective, I should mention that I started doing this type of analysis with a chemical manufacturing company about 2.5 years ago. At that time, oil price was at about $50 per barrel, and the company was wondering what will happen when oil price goes up all the way to $100 per barrel. 3% increase in their total cost. This is a company whose total supply chain cost is $40 billion. 3% increase in their total cost is more than $1 billion in direct impact on bottom line. And so this clearly gets the attention not only of director of logistics, director of distribution, even VP of supply chain. This really gets the attention of the people who run this company. And so this brings us to talk about the impact of oil price, first on transportation strategy, and then more generally on supply chain strategies. Let's start with transportation strategy. I claim that we will see as oil price change three important impacts. The first, companies, and we are already seeing this, companies are changing their strategy from just-in-time delivery to better utilization of transportation capacity. How can a company better utilize transportation capacity? There are two ways. First, shipping larger quantities, right, which implies more inventory. And second, efficient packaging to improve truck utilization. And of course, this allows them to reduce transportation costs. We also are going to see changes from quick delivery. This is a strategy that many companies have used to reduce inventory level, to cheaper and sometimes slower transportation mode. And in fact, we have examples of a move from for many companies from dedicated resources to shared resources. By dedicated resources, I typically mean private fleet, for example, private resources, and by shared resources, I refer, for instance, to third-party logistics. And the reason for third-party logistics switch is because these companies can consolidate shipment for many vendors and improve truck utilization. These third-party logistics companies can also reduce deadhead movements, right, the non-productive movement in the supply chain. And so these are things that you can achieve with shared resources and not with dedicated one. And the same is true for consolidated warehouses. And here are a few examples. Last year, SC Johnson reported that its truck utilization project saved the company about $1.5 billion and cut fuel consumption significantly. And the trick was to start mixing loads of different products on the same truck, loads of products that typically before were shipped separately. I don't know how many of the people in the audience heard about a company called ES3. ES3 has a giant distribution center in New York, Pennsylvania, where multiple manufacturers, many times competing manufacturers, store their product, and these products are shipped together from competing manufacturers, are shipped together on the same truck to various retail stores. And of course, the reason they do that is in order to cut transportation costs significantly. And as a result, if you look at the website of this company, you will see the reports on significant saving achieved on the transportation cost side using consolidated shipment and consolidated warehouses. What is the impact on supply chain strategies? I will emphasize three impacts. First, as oil price increase, and again, just compare 2002 and 2003 to 2008, we see significantly more inventory. We also see more and more emphasis on better service. What do I mean by that? What do companies do when service is low? When service level is low, what companies do, they expedite. They expedite shipment, but when transportation cost is relatively low, expediting cost is not a problem. As oil price increase, expediting cost becomes a big issue, and one way to address this is to achieve a higher service level by better managing your supply chain. And finally, I predict that we will see significantly less offshoring to reduce the total landed cost. The total landed cost is a cost associated with the production and delivery of product across the supply chain. And this is already happening. This is not something that we predict will happen 5-10 years from now. Here is one example. This is Sharp, who recently announced that they started moving manufacturing facilities from Asia to Mexico to serve its customers in North and South America. And there are two reasons for that. One is to reduce transportation cost, and the other one is because the price of LED TV typically falls very fast. In fact, on average, it falls about 10% per month. And so when the lead time from Asia to North America is about 40 days, Sharp is losing about 15% of the product price just because of the long lead time. Moving manufacturing to Mexico reduced lead time from 40 days to about 7 days, and therefore has a big impact on bottom line. So a question that you may ask, for what industries, for what type of product we are going to see a move from offshoring to inshoring? Well, let me suggest a framework that helps think about that. On the x-coordinate, I have what I call transportation impact. Here, I refer to how bulky the product is. Here, I refer to the impact of lead time on the price that you can charge, like in the case of Sharp. And here, I refer to the ratio between transportation cost and the sales price. On the Y coordinate, I look at the cost of moving the infrastructure, right? And the intuition is when the cost of moving the infrastructure is high, it will be difficult to change your sourcing strategy. But when it's low, it may be possible. And so look at box number one. Box number one represents industries where the transportation impact is high. I claim that here we already see movements. I mentioned Sharp for flat TVs. We see this happening for appliances. We see this happening even for furniture. Even when the transportation impact is low, but the cost of moving the infrastructure is low as well, we see already movements. And this is true, for example, for toys, as I will illustrate in my next slide. Where we don't see movement and we don't expect to see movement is where transportation impact is low and the cost of moving the infrastructure is high. Under these conditions, it will be hard to justify a movement from offshoring to nearshoring. This is true around PCs and mobile phones, and the reason for that is because the infrastructure, especially the supplier infrastructure, is very extensive and it's very difficult to move that infrastructure. And so here is an example of a company with product where the transportation impact is low, the cost of moving the infrastructure is low, and we see movement. This is Stief, the German manufacturer of toys. Many of you know about this company. About 5-7 years ago, the company moved about 20% of its manufacturing activities, of its production, to low-cost country. And the objective was to cut costs in order to compete on price. But recently, in the last 12 months, the company started moving production back to close to market demand, to Tunisia, Portugal, and Germany. And there are two reasons for that. One, quality problems, and the other one is, according to the company, high transportation costs. And so I want to summarize the analysis by emphasizing that it's really not only about oil price. We talked about oil price, but it's also about significant changes in labor cost. For example, if you look at what happened between 2003 and 2008, in terms of average annual wage, in China, it increased by about 19% year to year in the last 5 years. In the U.S., only by 3%. In Brazil, by 21%, whereas in Mexico, by no more than 5% year to year. So clearly, the increase in China and Brazil is significantly faster than the increase, say, in the U.S. or in Mexico. Again, driving manufacturing to at least consider moving closer to market demand. And so I can suggest a framework to think about this that allows you to get an insight into what's happening in industry. On the X coordinate, I have information on transportation cost per unit. This may be proportional to the weight of the product or to the volume of the product. And on the Y coordinate, I look at production cost per unit if this product is produced in the U.S. And if you look at this region, you can partition this region into three areas. A represent product where the ratio between production cost per unit and transportation cost per unit is very high. When this ratio is very high, and this is true, for example, for light product, when this ratio is very high, you expect that this product will be produced in low-cost countries like in Asia, China, Thailand. B represent product where this ratio is very low. When this ratio is very low and it is low for heavy product, then you expect that this product will be produced close to market demand, say even in the U.S. And for region C, we expect somewhere in between, perhaps Mexico or perhaps other countries in Latin America. And indeed, we verified this Through another case study. This is a large manufacturer of products like hardwood, ceramic tile, carpets. And we wanted to understand, our objective was to understand the impact of transportation, changes in transportation cost and labor cost. Just a quick insight on this company, more than 30,000 different products. Production cost varies from less than $1 per unit to about $300 per unit. If production is in the U.S., weight vary from below 1 pound to 5,000 pounds per unit. Three manufacturing strategies producing in the U.S., in Mexico, or in China, and a combination of transportation modes that we had to consider. You can see here the sourcing strategy in 2008. If you look at the different colors, the color code is that blue represents products that are produced in China, yellow in Mexico, and green in the U.S. On the X coordinate, I have the weight of the product, which is proportional to transportation cost, and on the Y, I have production costs in the U.S. You can see that only the light products are produced in Asia. Many products are produced in Mexico, and many are produced in the U.S., and in the U.S., these are the heavy product. You may be interested in comparing this strategy to the strategy in 2003. Before I show you the difference between the 2003 strategy and the 2008 strategy, let me just mention that in the U.S., during this period of 5 years, labor cost increased by a total of 15%, in Mexico by 23%, and in China by 144%. And transportation cost increased by the number that we talked about earlier. You can see here the impact on ocean freight and truckload and rail. And here it is. On the right-hand side, you see the strategy for 2008, and on the left-hand side, the strategy for 2003. Color code remained the same, blue China, yellow Mexico, and green the U.S. You can see that in 2003, almost everything is produced in China, whereas in 2008, many of the products have moved from China to either Mexico or even closer to market demand in North America. And I think I will stop here.
Okay, well, thank you very much for a very interesting presentation. Again, if you do think of any questions for this presentation, please feel free to type them in and we'll address them at the end. We are going to move on now to Greg Forbes of Walmart. So Greg, when you're ready, you can begin.
Thank you, Jennifer. David, nice job. Well, I'm Greg Forbes. I again work with our corporate traffic side, which is primarily focused on the inbound movement of freight into our distribution centers, in stores and clubs, but I'm also a part of our corporate transportation department, which is also one of the largest private fleets in the United States. So what I want to talk about today is give you a little bit of background on Walmart stores from a procurement standpoint, and then our reach of operations across the global, from a global perspective, and then focus specifically on transportation. What have we done in corporate traffic, working with our suppliers and with our merchandising teams, to help reduce the offset of rising fuel prices that we've seen over the last year, as well as what has our private fleet done and logistics done to help offset those costs at the same time. And so you'll probably see some similarities between David's slides and mine, and some things that we're working on are very similar to some things that he has talked about, and I think dovetail each other very nicely. So from the first slide, this is really where we are procuring globally today. United States, Canada, South America, as well as Asia, and et cetera. And so you can see we've got a pretty broad brush of different places where we are buying product from today, some locally sourced where our stores are, and some where we do not have stores or clubs today. The second slide really gives you an idea of our distribution center impact that we have in the United States across the global nation. And that one number, that's actually about three DCs too low. We've opened three within the last year, two of those being Sam's DCs, but we're actually at 225 DCs across the United States, with the biggest footprint being in the United States today. And so you can see the impact that we have from a distribution center perspective. And then from a store and club internationally, we're a little over 3,100 units as a company globally. And that includes we're in 14 countries today. And we do have one joint venture operation in India, which is with the Bharti Enterprises, and continue to grow in our international division. Domestically, we have a little over 4,200 units. That would include stores, clubs, neighborhood markets, and then recently we just opened four smaller grocery store operations in the Phoenix market. Total about 8 million truckloads in and out of our stores and clubs and distribution centers, of which our private fleet moves about 50% of that on the inbound side and 100% of it on the outbound side. So now what I want to transition into is you've seen a little bit of our store and club operation and our impact globally. What I'd like to touch on next is really understand how our distribution flows work, and that will lead me into some of the things that we're working on. This is a snapshot of what our import flows look like, kind of pictorial. It's a little easier to understand. Obviously, as we're procuring from those countries that I showed you on the previous slides, all of those are coming via ocean over to the United States. We have six ports of entry today where we're bringing goods into from L.A. Long Beach, the SeaTac area, Seattle-Tacoma area. We have one inland operation in Chicago, which the international containers come intact via the railroad from Seattle and from L.A. into Chicago. We operate in the Port of Houston, Savannah, Charleston, and in the Port of Norfolk. So today, those vessels come in. Our containers are offloaded into our import or our storage facilities. About 30% of that product is stored, and about the remaining 70% flows right onto our distribution centers. We have a variety of methods to move it between the import facilities to the to our distribution centers. We use common carrier, truckload carrier, and then we also use our own private fleet. And once it's in the regional distribution center network, and then it moves on to the stores via our private fleet. The snapshot of what our domestic network looks like, very similar. The only piece that's really missing is the ocean piece. This is the remainder of our product flows domestically, picking up from a supplier manufacturer into our distribution centers and then onto our stores. This is just a snapshot of our supplier network, and you can see from the red circles are really the heavier ship points that we have, with the concentration of that really being focused kind of in the Midwest, but we also have two large facilities, a large supplier base that ship out of Southern California, as well as the Pacific Northwest today. So what's really our focus as it relates to reducing the impact of freight costs or of fuel costs today? And we have kind of a really five-pronged approach that we've taken internally within our corporate transportation market. And as we have focused on sustainability, and I think you saw from David's slides the impact of transportation cost and inventory costs on just total logistics cost overall, we're now really trying to focus on how do we reduce those costs and have challenges that our leadership have put out amongst us. Say, how do we reduce freight costs? So the first real approach that we've taken is intermodal. Today, most of our intermodal movements off the West Coast, specifically Southern California, Northern California, and the Pacific Northwest, to points east of the Mississippi, are all moving intermodal today, and they have for quite some time. And that's approximately about around 20% of our freight spend is spent intermodally. What we have seen change this year is a lot more intermodal movements on the eastern half of the United States. For example, Chicago into the Northeast, which typically were trucking markets, over-the-road markets in the past, Chicago to Florida, Texas to Florida. Those markets in the past have been typically over-the-road. But as we modeled those pricing in our bids, we were able to also model the an impact of the intermodal fuel surcharge, which is about 50% of what the truck fuel surcharge is, and allowed us to make some of those movements now become more cost-effective with prices of fuel in the $4 range. Ship point optimization is really alignment of our ship points to our distribution centers, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in shipment optimization along with packaging in the next few slides. The last piece around supply chain precision is, as we have reduced inventory levels in our stores and clubs and distribution centers over the last couple of years, we are really focused on flowing the product in closer to when it's needed. For example, Halloween costumes typically don't sell the first part of October. A lot of folks go out and buy the majority of their Halloween costumes the last week in October. And so how we want to work with our suppliers and our merchants so that we have some presence of Halloween costumes early in the month, when we know those folks, that certain percentage of them will come in and buy them, but really put the majority of that merchandise into the store right before the event happens, so that we're reducing our inventory carrying cost as much as possible. So reducing transportation expense, there's really two ways to do that. Is obviously minimizing distance. The closer you are from the supplier to our distribution centers, the better off we are. We're able to react much closer to out-of-stock demands. But we also reduce the lead time, and that's the most significant piece in our supply chain. And we can do this a couple ways, is that by adding additional ship points into the mix, and I've got a couple slides that will talk to that a little bit later, and then continue to focus on reducing that. Then we also look at optimize our shipment size. Today we move a variety of methods of freight, from small package to LTL to truckload, to even we touch on intermodal, and we've been able over the last year and a half is to really make modal changes to move some of those shipments that were shipping small package before to maybe ordering less frequently, and now moving those into less than truckload, and then moving up from LTL to truckload, and etc. So this is a great example, and probably one very similar to what you saw on David's slide. This is one of our analysis that our merchandise and logistics team did for a buyer, and the analysis was that today this supplier domestically sources, we pick it up domestically in the U.S. in Long Beach, California, shipping to all 42 of our regional distribution centers. So you can see an average distance a little over 1,826 miles, and with some significant lead times in the equation, L.A. to Miami or Fort Pierce, Florida, it's probably 15 days to 20 days by rail intermodally versus a closer in-ship one. In this scenario, we were able to work with the supplier, and they were able to open a facility in Dallas, Texas. So we've now reduced the average distance from over 1,800 miles down to 784 miles. We're now within 5-day transits versus 10 to 15-day transits in a lot of cases, depending on where the facility is. We're now much quicker to our shelf for our customers, so we can be in stock when our consumer comes into shop. We've also reduced the lead time, and anytime you reduce the lead time, you obviously will be able to reduce inventory throughout that equation. And then the most important part is that we're able to react much quicker to out of stocks. If you come into one of our stores or clubs and it's not on the shelf, that does not make you happy, and we want to make sure we have happy customers that continue to come back. The other piece that we focused on as a group is really looking at shipment sizes. And we have, over time, our system has, the way our suppliers enter shipments into our systems for us to assign a truck to and move, has been able to be manipulated over time. And we found great examples of just being able to maximize the trailer cube, put two more pallets of water on the back of the trailer. We're still within the legal weight limits of what the tractor can haul, but at the same time, we've reduced about every two pallets you add to a truck, over 10 trucks, you're reducing a truckload. So we're able to really focus on that. And over time, as our supplier settings have changed, as equipment has changed, we've been able to add more volume to that truck. And I give you a great example. We were in Southern California about 3 weeks ago. We're visiting one of our consolidation facilities, and we had a toy manufacturer that had built a special display for us. And as we were looking at the trailers coming inbound to our distribution center, we noticed that it was about one pallet layer, nose to tail. We started making inquiries and talking to the supplier, and the supplier said, yes, the merchandise is stackable. So we were able to double stack that and immediately cut our transportation costs in half by 50%, which is significant on the freight spend that we have over time. Second piece that we've done is synchronized order days. And I think you saw from David's slide, he referenced a 3PL company in York, Pennsylvania that has multiple suppliers in it. And a lot of those suppliers are probably shipping to a Walmart Stores Incorporated. And we have a lot of this in Southern California specifically. But within that same million square foot facility where they may have 15 different suppliers, their hounds that are shipping to them, the way our replenishment system was working, we would drop an order for Coleman, Alabama, for example, from Southern California. That order would drop for supplier one on Monday, for supplier two on Tuesday, and for supplier three on Wednesday. And now we're shipping three less than full truckload shipments when we can synchronize all those order days by department and by supplier. And now all those orders all drop to the, all the Coleman, Alabama orders drop to Southern California. On Monday, we're able to bump up from LTL-type quantities into truckload quantities and move the product much quicker and much faster. We've been able to work with our supplier, with our merchants on lead time settings within our system. And obviously, as you increase lead time, that puts more safety stock into our distribution networks. And as you reduce them, it also takes inventory out. But the biggest piece that impacts us is the variability. Today we may ship less than truckload, and tomorrow we ship truckload. So you have a five-day transit, and today you have a two-day transit. So what we've been able to do is work with our merchants and our suppliers and make sure we have accurate lead times in there, and so that they can accurately put the right amount of inventory in the location that it needs. And then something very simple is correct item file weights and dimensions. A great example, we had a supplier that was calling in pallet quantities, calling in their case dimensions. So it was about 50 cubed, equal about one pallet. And as we started asking questions, we found out that they were actually shipping in one case that weighed about 3 pounds. It was dark tips, I believe, was the item. And we were, and they were shipping those at LTL quantities. So we're paying an LTL carrier minimum when we could be paying a small package fee for those items. The next, probably the biggest impact that I believe that we have seen from a transportation perspective, and it's really had an impact, I believe, across the United States, and Walmart has only begun to touch the surface from what we're working on, and that's the packaging initiative. And the reduction in package that we've had over this year, we've just started. And here's some examples of things where we may have eliminated resin. But Hamburger Helper is probably one of my favorite examples. Something as simple as taking the noodle in the Hamburger Helper, instead of shipping it curled up, they're manufacturing it flat. The noodle still curls when you cook it. But we're able to take a 20% reduction in the carton size, 11% reduction in greenhouse gases by taking 500 fewer trucks on the road off each year. And that's just one example, but you've also heard items where Unilever and Procter & Gamble have taken the water out of their laundry detergent, make it a more concentrated formula, and reduce the size of the packaging, so that now you can actually hold more quantities on the shelf versus having some in the back stock and some on the shelf. But we've also reduced over 25 to 30,000 truckloads just into Walmart stores. But as Walmart focuses on this with our suppliers, we're also seeing the benefit, and the other merchants and other retailers are also seeing the benefit of it. Procter & Gamble doesn't only sell to Walmart from that perspective. whether you're talking about the transition in technology from iPods to from boomboxes to iPods, from tube TVs to flat panel TVs, the challenges are all the same. And we saw, as an example, when we went from tube TVs to flat panel TVs, we actually were shipping more truckloads until our folks started digging into it and asking the right questions and finding out that, hey, maybe we can double stack a pallet here or turn a pallet this way and we can get more on the product. And we've been able to reduce the amount of truckloads of televisions we're shipping. Packaging has an impact, and what is probably more acceptable today than it has been in the past, our suppliers are focused on it, and we'll continue to see the impacts of that on freight volumes. At the same time, less trucks help us save fuel cost in the long run. Next, I'd like to touch on kind of the back half on what have we in logistics done from an environmental sustainability standpoint, with a real focus on fuel efficiency in our private fleet. And I'll touch a little bit on what we've done on the distribution center side of our network, but more focus will be really on the fuel. So our goals for logistics around sustainability are a 25% reduction in carbon footprint in our existing facilities by 2012, a 30% reduction in any new prototypes that we're building from 2009 going forward. And those two items also apply to our stores and our clubs that we're building. Material recovery facility in all our return center locations. So we have about 10 facilities where we take back store returns, which would be damaged merchandise or product that doesn't work. And some of that stuff in the past just went into dumpsters and went straight into the landfills. But we've been able to recover items such as plastic and metals from those items and been able to sell them off in the markets where they've been needed. And then really the piece that was our biggest challenge was around fleet efficiency, that we would improve 25% our fuel efficiency in our private fleet. That should actually say by 2009, I apologize for that error on the slide, and then by 100% in 2015. Some quick wins that we've had across the network. We talked a little bit about the recycling initiatives that we've done. We've done a lot of stuff in our distribution centers where we're focused on recycling cardboard and shrink wrap. We've done some hydrogen cell testing for lift trucks in a couple of our facilities, and that's an ongoing test. We've seen good results in some places, and some places not as good. So we continue to work with the manufacturers to improve the technology and help us get better at it. We're a member of EPA Smartway member, Clean Cargo Sustainable Global Transportation Group member. We've implemented auxiliary power units, and I'll talk a little bit more about that, on our truck fleet over the past year. Saved over 100,000 metric tons of CO2 and $25 million saved annually, just the price of fuel that we've had to purchase. A couple things our distribution centers are focused on and have been working on this year. We're looking at more energy efficient conveyor systems. We have 120 facilities in our network, of which about 60 of those are mechanized, have some sort of mechanization in them. How do we take out the energy use out of that facility by working with more effective engines, et cetera? Working on lighting retrofits, we've gone in and changed the lighting to more energy efficient lighting within our distribution centers that actually put off more light and make it a better and safer environment for our associates to work in. We've added skylights into several of our distribution centers. Again, talked about recycling. And then refrigeration at our grocery distribution centers. We've looked for more efficient ways in recycling, and how do we recycle energy back through that unit so we don't use as much to cool the building as we need to. The next slide, this is an example of some of the things that we're working on around our fleet, and how did we achieve the 25% improvement in efficiency, and then how do we get to 100% efficiency in our fleet by 2015. We've been engaged with several trailer manufacturers over the past year to really look at how do we close the gap between the back of the cab of the tractor and the nose of that trailer, whether that's different aerodynamic packages on the tractor. But you can tell from this picture we have some skirting that's put on the bottom of the trailer, and then some fairings on the back of the trailer that kind of help reduce that wind resistance. Trailer aerodynamics can improve MPG by as much your fuel efficiency up to about 6% in some cases. So we continue to focus on different ways. And how do we lighten the trailer, take weight out of the trailer? So we've done several things as it relates to trailer innovations. Tires, one of our focuses on tires has been, we started using nitrogen to fill air in our tires versus air. We've picked up a couple percentage points in that. We've also focused on more fuel-efficient tires, which increases the tire life and has given us a lift from a fuel efficiency standpoint. The next one is probably where we've seen our biggest win on improvement in fuel efficiency. The auxiliary power units, we're placing them on all of our trucks over the past year, and about a year and a half ago is when we finished the installation. They're standard on all new trucks now that we bring into our fleet. We're proud that we are one of the first private fleets in mass to really go after the auxiliary power unit because we could calculate a payback and a return on our investment on them and knew that we could see savings. It's really, for those of you that don't know what an APU is, it's an alternate power source so that when the driver's on the road, taking a break, or having to sleep in the cab of their tractor, and so on, it's providing a comfort for the driver. So it runs the heating and the cooling system. And then any electrical power, a lot of the drivers will have a small refrigerator or maybe a small microwave in their cab that they can hook and keep and heat with. So this really helps that. The other thing the APUs really did for us is support our corporate no idle policy. We have a policy at all of our distribution centers and stores where our tractors, as well as third-party carriers that are coming to visit us, we ask them not to idle their truck. If our tractor idles for more than 3 minutes, the APU actually kicks on and shuts down the engine from that perspective. This is kind of a chart of where we hope to get to by the end of this year. We're actually at a 21% efficiency. We've seen a 21% improvement in our fuel efficiency this past year, and we've identified about another 7%, almost 8% in items that we can continue to gain efficiencies out of, whether it's fuel-efficient tires. The APU is real. That's right at 8%. We've done some different testing with additives, which gives us close to 2%. We've reduced the weight on the tractor and the trailer, and then really focused on aerodynamic packages around our truck and trailer. We think we can get another almost 9% improvement. And then our ProStar truck that we run today is about 4%. And most of that comes in the gearing ratio as well as aerodynamics of the vehicle. So how do we get to 100% fuel efficiency by 2015? We think one of the big ways that we can get there is by hybrid diesel technology. And you can see the different components that make up the hybrid diesel. We think this is really a brand new area for us to get into, but we believe that there's a lot of opportunity. You've seen the growth with hybrid vehicles across the United States, and we think this can get us anywhere from 25 to 35% improvement in fuel efficiency. We're focused on aerodynamics. Again, we talked about new trailer design, new truck platform. If you've had a chance to look at any of the transportation magazines lately, you'll see a lot of manufacturers are touting the benefits of their aerodynamic package that they can offer on their tractors and their trailers. And then just some of the last other initiatives that we believe can get us some additional fuel efficiencies. Obviously, where we can make changes to the length of the tractor-trailer combination within the legal limits, we want to do that. Where we can make adjustments on weight of the vehicles, whether we're running lighter weight equipment or running day cabs without sleepers, and can it help us pull a little bit bigger payload still within legal limits that can then allow us to take a truck here or a trailer here off the load off the street. And in a lot of cases, we've not elected as a company to turn down the speed of our tractors. Our drivers have actually come to us and said, hey, take a couple miles per hour off. We're governing it at 63 miles per hour now. And they said, hey, come back and take another mile or two off my tractor. I don't need that top end. And that's obviously helped from a fuel efficiency standpoint. And then spending time with some of the best truck drivers in the world, and which we believe our fleet drivers are today, just training them and educating them on different things that they can do as a driver things from an operational standpoint, I think, that are important to understand. Not only are we trying to put more on the trailer on the inbound side, as we ship from our distribution centers to our stores, we partner with our DCs and really help them drive improvements in cartons per trailer. And so we've actually seen about an 8 to 10% improvement in how many more cases we can get on a trailer, which has obviously reduced the number of loads and the number of miles that we have to run as a company, and the ability to reduce empty miles even further so our drivers aren't driving out a route, and et cetera. Our average distance from our DCs to our stores is a little over 120 miles. And so we've not added any new DCs in the last couple of years. We're about where we need to be, but where we can reduce that inbound distance from our suppliers, we'll do it. Then we actually run some doubles programs up in New York on the freeway, and then down in Florida, and partnering with the FEC, we run some of those programs to the south. This picture is just a snapshot of our hybrid technology. Talk a little bit more detail. It's a partnership with Eaton and Peterbilt that we've embarked on over the last year. We continue to look for ways. Today we've tested the tractor. It's gone through two or three different prototype changes. We believe we can get anywhere from about 7 to 8% improvement in fuel efficiency with this tractor. Today we have a 5-truck test in three different states: California, Texas, and Georgia, I believe, are the states where we have these trucks at. And just trying to test them in different climates and different terrains to see how they perform and really benchmark those studies. By the end of this year, we'll have taken possession of 25 hybrid diesels that we'll be running in our network to continue to see how well they do. And then just really to wrap up, our two goals for our private fleet are 25% improvement. We're 21% of the way there. We've got about 4% to go, and we believe that we can get there this year. 100% improvement by FY16, which would be our calendar year 2015. And, in our company, we try and set big goals, and whether they may be attainable or not, we're going to certainly swing away at the ball until we get a hit and do whatever we can. And a safe, efficient supply chain is really environmentally sustainable, reducing congestion, emissions, and cost to our company and to our customers. Ultimately, we can put that money back into the cost of the product and be able to reduce cost at the shelf level for our consumers. So really, sustainability for Walmart has really been a large return on investment for us as a company, but not only to our customers. So I thank you for your time today, Jennifer, and I will turn it back over to you.
Thank you, Greg. Another great presentation. I'm going to turn it over now to Barbara Ivanov of the Washington State DOT, who's going to give the state DOT perspective. There are no slides for this presentation, so I'm just going to bring back up our introductory slide. So, Barbara, you can go ahead.
Thank you, Jennifer. And again, thanks to the speakers for some very logical, thoughtful presentations. I can tell you what we're thinking about in Washington State based on the changing price of fuel. I sent out a couple articles that help confirm that we're in a period of wild gyrations, not only regarding fuel prices, but other conditions. So first, to state the obvious, as agencies whose primary source of revenue is tied to a fuel tax, whether the economy slows and there's fewer goods shipped, or the economy picks up and you've got more goods shipped, and companies making strategic initiatives to drive down their use of fuel, I think we can, with high probability, assume that we're going to have continued pressure on revenues. And that kind of discipline isn't all bad. So on the what can we do, what's our response category, I see James Schultz noted that in the chat room here. What should we do to reduce costs? I think you always want to manage what you can actually control. So before we think about policies that are way outside of our control, let's start with what we can do. And the optimal strategy is one, I believe, that provides near-term value to our shippers and carriers at the lowest cost. Okay? And some long-term flexibility, because we can't control long-term conditions. So The goal, again, of freight systems, as understood by WSDOT, is to support comparative advantage for our region, our state's freight-dependent industries, right? So that means we're completely mode neutral. I have no interest, don't really care on how that happens, but we're looking at strategies that provide comparative advantage for those freight-dependent industries. I would say then you need to know who are those freight-dependent industries in your region, in your state. And we don't want to work blind. We want to develop a customer intelligence system that, after identification of those industries, provides us with ongoing information about their performance requirements and the performance gaps that they see existing on our state or our region's freight systems. So that optimal strategy, again, to provide near-term value to shippers and carriers at the lowest cost is going to focus on operational efficiencies first. And when you're looking at operational efficiencies, and I think my colleague at Walmart said it very well, very specific strategies that they can control that drive out waste. Not only does that cut costs, but it produces some environmental benefits that were, again, great public benefits. So what are the causes of operational waste that a DOT or an MPO controls? Number one, we think it's poor information on current or future road conditions. And I know Tony was going to reference this when he speaks, but the need for DOTs and MPOs to develop situational awareness across their organizations that then is fed into some sort of decision process and then pushed out through a freight notification system so that whether it's Walmart or Safeway or your local wheat farmer or a manufacturer, they know in real time what the road conditions are and what construction plans or what sort of predictive information we can give them so that they can plan their shipment moves most efficiently. I'd say that's one area where we can continue to do better work. I think another one is the lack of regional corridor standards. On the West Coast, our primary highway corridor is I-5, runs north-south, really through all three nations, and certainly through the three West Coast states. We do not have currently for trucking companies one-stop permitting, integrated truck traveler information, again, real-time information about access to truck parking, knowing where there are slots available or not. So there's lots of good steps we could make as we move forward. And they're not always tremendously expensive. You know, my other piece of advice to myself is don't wait for a federal grant. I will say in terms of this issue of information, that again provides real-time road information and predictive information to shippers and carriers. Many of you who have the misfortune to be on my email list know that our freight listserv we developed in the last winter storm season was run on my desktop, up in the attic in our transportation building. And so start with what you have, right? Which is internally, again, developing that situational awareness. If you're running a big state like California or Texas, and even in our small state of Washington, knowing what's happening all over the state and every highway and every region means some shift in priorities within our agency. And then developing a reliable, robust freight notification system so our customers will have that, again, in real time, I think is something that is a fairly low-cost way to us support this initiative to cut waste in the system. And I think the last on the long term, again, come back to this issue again, don't work blind. You're trying to lower our risk, right, long term of investing other people's money, public money, in corridors or projects that aren't going to provide much payout 15, 20 years from now. So in order to do that, we talk about scenario planning, long-range planning, and thinking through developing strategies that are going to have payoff in various scenarios. And with that, I will turn to my colleague, Tony, who's again thought about this on a much grander scale and worked with many estates.
Thank you, Barbara. And thank you, David and Greg, for two really fantastic presentations. I agree with Barb wholeheartedly on the kind of tactical side, the operational side within an individual state. But when you start taking a look at the entire nation, you almost have to shift to the strategic level. And remember, what drives freight movement is the demographics and the demand, and on the other side, of course, the production centers that produce the goods that are consumed by the population. So when we look at where the demographics are and where the major input points are to the U.S., you can identify a whole host of corridors, national strategic corridors through which the freight is moving. And at the national level, that's kind of where we need to be focusing our interest, is where are those corridors and how can we make sure that those corridors move as efficiently or allow the movement of goods as efficiently as they possibly can. And when we think about the corridors, it's not just from the highway side, but as Barb said, from a multimodal perspective, which is the most efficient mode of transportation to move the goods. It's interesting when you looked at David's slide and also at Greg's presentation, when they decided to move the distribution center from Las Vegas to Albuquerque, Los Angeles, and Portland, that decision was reached at a tipping point of about $150 a barrel of oil. But all of a sudden, the freight patterns in Las Vegas changed remarkably, and the same in Albuquerque, probably not so much for Los Angeles, but probably for Portland as well. I don't know that there's any way any individual state DOT could predict that kind of change, other than kind of working with the local community, the shipping community, and the freight community to get better intel on what their thinking is regarding how they would do things along those lines. So tapping into the expert knowledge that the carriers have as they move goods throughout your local community, through your state DOT areas, and for us to engage as we are now with the shipping community to understand what their needs are and where they want to move goods throughout the United States, so that we get a better understanding of what the issues and the parameters are that push and pull them in a whole host of different directions. We've got about 10 minutes left, and I know there are a whole host of questions that we have in the chat thing, so Jennifer, I'll turn it over to you so that we can get the questions asked of our presenters.